when could the first round of COVID vaccines be given in our country? We're learning about vaccine rollout, what it takes, what is known here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Friday, we learned Pfizer applied for emergency use authorization for the COVID vaccine with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The FDA says its vaccines advisory committee is set to meet in 16 days from now. Are you a frontline healthcare worker? What do you want to know about this ambitious vaccination timeline? Are you in the general healthy population? Will you get vaccinated? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dyle Hewlett Jr. is an infectious disease specialist and medical director of the Disease Control Division and deputy commissioner at the Westchester County Department of Health in New York. Dr. Hewlett, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you very much for having me again. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, let's get the lay of the land here. Drug companies Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca have leading COVID vaccine candidates. Several others remain in the works and development. Break down what you know about the status of these vaccine candidates.
Well, what we know is very, very promising. The two candidates that are farthest along in development are the Pfizer candidate, which has shown 95% efficacy in the phase three trials, and also the Moderna candidate, which has shown 94% efficacy in phase 3 trials. Both of these candidates are very far along, and as you indicated, the Pfizer candidate is going to be applying for emergency use authorization with the FDA in a very short time. And if that is granted, then it is conceivable that this product will be available for use possibly as early as the end of December or certainly by the beginning of January.
Well, what does an emergency use authorization actually do? Can you break that down?
Yes, I can. Emergency use authorization means that you have usually a situation such as this current pandemic that is an emergency, a healthcare emergency, where lives are at stake and a product that has shown promise should be made available as soon as possible. The emergency use authorization occurs before the formal FDA approval of the product. And so there's enough data available, at least if the FDA feels that there's enough data available for them to review it very quickly and grant this authorization while the complete review is completed. That is, while the complete review is done, that actually is emergency use. While emergency use authorization is underway, data is still being collected. And those individuals who receive the product under emergency use usually have to sign a consent form similar to what is done when the clinical trials are underway, when an individual enters a clinical trial. So it is different than when the product has full FDA approval.
Yeah. What can you say to reassure people that a vaccine approved under an EUA is just as safe and effective as one approved under the biologics license application process, even though there isn't, you know, as much long-term effectiveness data going on?
Well, we have to say that we don't have as much information as would have when the full approval is available. However, you have several different groups of experts who are looking at this data. And I think that all of the scientists and other medical experts that are looking at this data, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is, of course, one of the leaders in the field, all of them have felt that the data that's available thus far is very favorable. And I certainly share that view, that from what we've seen thus far, not only in terms of the efficacy data from the products that have been reporting it, but also this, more importantly, the safety data. All of these vaccines, if they are going to be receiving emergency use authorization, will have to have a minimum amount of safety data available. That is, it's my understanding that all of the patients who were in this trial or all of the individuals in this trial will have been followed for a period of at least 2 months. And it's during that 2 month period that we would expect most of the common adverse events or side effects to occur.
We're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who's an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. He's fielding questions about a COVID vaccine and rollout, 800-642-1234. Emma is joining us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Emma. What is your question?
Hi. I was wondering, there seems to be some sort of a plan for who's going to get a vaccine first and where all that is. And I was wondering where college students are on that, because it is kind of a large group of people sort of stuck in a couple of buildings, especially with the dorm. And the college that I've been going to has already been shut down twice for COVID. And I have friends who have had to quarantine or have had to go into the quarantine dorms. And I've been just wondering where we are on that.
Yeah. Emma, thank you for that question. Great question. Dr. Hewlett, can you break down who would get the vaccine and when?
Yes, I can. I can't be as explicit about when, but I can share with you what I've learned about the ordering of who is going to actually receive the vaccine first. And as we understand it, our healthcare providers are first on the list. So those individuals who are physicians, nurses, technicians, individuals who are essentially supporting our hospitals and clinics and other medical facilities, our first responders, such as our EMS workers, and individuals who are also other first responders, such as our police and fire, they will be the first people on the list because of the essential role that they play in supporting our healthcare system. In the next group, I have been told, and we have learned, that that is going to include some of our most vulnerable populations, such as our residents of long-term nursing care facilities, residents, older residents of assisted living facilities. And I think then we will start to talk about the next group, which will be individuals who are possibly immunocompromised or individuals who have underlying morbidity factors, which place them at high risk or higher risk should they get infection. And these are people with underlying cardiovascular disease or respiratory disease, individuals with respiratory problems like asthma that would predispose them to poor outcomes if they should become infected. Now, certainly, as you have mentioned, Emma, individuals who are in congregate settings are certainly at a higher risk. And college students, as well as individuals who may be incarcerated, certainly fall into that category, as well as others who may be in congregate settings. But they would not necessarily be at the very top of the list, but certainly residents within a congregate setting is considered to be a risk factor for the acquisition of disease. And this is certainly being taken into account.
We're talking about what may be the most ambitious vaccination program in our history and about a COVID vaccine, what is known now. We have infectious disease specialist Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is on the COVID-19 Task Force on Vaccines and Therapeutics. What do you think of the work of Operation Warp Speed? Are you optimistic that a vaccine will work in stopping this pandemic? Are you working on vaccine distribution plans for your organization? Who has a seat at the table? What is your group talking about in logistics and who is prioritized? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Hewlett here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what a nationwide COVID vaccine rollout may look like. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal government, through Operation Warp Speed, has been working to make one or more COVID vaccines available ASAP. The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says public confidence in the vaccine approval process is key on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday.
So if you have a highly efficacious vaccine and only a relatively small 40-50% of the people get vaccinated, mm-hmm. you're not going to get the herd immunity you need. What we do need is we need to get as many people as possible vaccinated.
And we're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist, member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. He's our guide. So, Dr. Hewlett, does the oversight end once a vaccine is authorized, or what happens once a vaccine is authorized in how you follow it and study it?
Yes, well, that's a very important question. And when a vaccine is under emergency use authorization, one of the terms that has to be met is that the sponsor or the manufacturer is obligated to provide safety information on all of the individuals who are receiving the product. And so, although it is not a formal clinical trial, the individuals are followed as if they were in a clinical trial. And so any untoward events that may occur to individuals has to be reported, and that information is tabulated, and that occurs during emergency use authorization. Even after the vaccine is fully approved by the FDA, as we understand it, the manufacturers are going to be under obligation to do what we call long-term safety studies. So these long-term safety studies may last for about 2 years, and during that period of time, the manufacturer is obligated to follow all of the individuals who are receiving the vaccine and to keep track of any untoward events that may be occurring and reporting these events to the FDA so that it can all be monitored. And so just because the vaccine has been approved, that does not mean that there's no longer going to be monitoring of safety and tolerability. One of the other things that happens when there's FDA approval, following FDA approval, there is also a review of the data by another group called the American Committee on Immunization Practices. We call it the ACIP. And that group reviews the data, and they actually make recommendations on the way in which the vaccine should be given. Who are the groups that should be receiving the vaccine, and what are some of the stipulations? And this is important because the clinical trials that have been done thus far have not included individuals under the age of 18, although there are trials that are ongoing looking at pediatrics. They have not included individuals who are pregnant, and that's very important because we know that pregnant women have been placed at a higher risk for having morbid events and even death as a result of COVID. And so this committee can make recommendations that may extend the use of the product beyond the groups that have been studied previously while data is being accumulated.
We're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist, member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee, and we're exploring the steps of a COVID vaccine approval and distribution with your questions at 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, John. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, hi. I saw an article last night on my news feed that the possible adverse reactions to the first shot when you get the vaccine, and if the doctors and vaccine manufacturers need to be honest about that, because otherwise people may be hesitant to come back for the second shot. As well, you get during the trials, were there adverse reactions like that, or have you heard anything about that?
So asking about adverse reactions and side effects, how transparent is that? What do we know?
I can start to answer that for John. And this is a very important question, John, and thank you, because the two candidates that are going to be out first, both of those vaccine candidates, both the candidate from Pfizer as well as the candidate from Moderna, they require a second dose. With one of the products, the second dose is to be administered 21 days following the first dose. For the second candidate, it is 28 days following the first dose. And you're absolutely correct. If someone has untoward events or adverse events or effects after the first dose, then they won't be as likely to want to come back for the second dose. What we know so far, and I believe and I'm sure, I feel very confident that the manufacturers have been very transparent about this. The most common adverse events that occur are very, very mild. And it appears that most of the adverse events that might be a bit more uncomfortable occur after the second dose as opposed to after the first dose. But things such as soreness in the arm, in the injection site, sometimes there can be what we call a flu-like illness, where a person for a day or so may feel like they have the flu. These are the kinds of things that have occurred. So far, very fortunately, for these two candidates, there have not been serious types of events that would really require halting the trial or anything of that nature. So we're very, very confident about this. But I do agree with you, John, that we have to make sure that that we adjust the expectations so that people know what to expect when they receive the first dose as well as when they receive the second dose. And we also have to make absolutely sure that people come back for that second dose, because if they don't come back for the second dose, then they are only going to be partially protected.
Well, on that issue of vaccine hesitancy, which is a major issue with COVID, and you've been talking about people being included in the study and the diversity of these studies, Black Americans are particularly hesitant about a COVID vaccine. And one study found that less than 20% of Black Americans believe that the vaccine will be safe or effective. What can you say about that and the needs of making sure that communities of color feel safe in taking these vaccines?
Yes, that's a very important question also. And really the purpose of the task force that I am participating in the National Medical Association task force, our job or our mission really is to serve as what we call trusted messengers, so that we will be able to pass along information to members of our community, because we want to be able to pass along objective, accurate information to our community. And I think that it's important for your listeners also to know that not only is this task force working with the National Medical Association and the African American community, but also other communities such as our Latinx communities, our Asian American communities, our indigenous Native American communities. We have been working with a coalition, if you will, that has been trying to design information that is tailored to the needs of all of these communities so that everyone will be educated about the vaccine and everyone will feel comfortable and confident when they go to get the vaccine.
Donnell is joining us from Fall River this morning. Hi, Donnell.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is for you in regards to the vaccine on who's getting the shot. How do you determine if you are a caregiver, a non-family caregiver for multiple people, when you are going to be able to receive the vaccine?
So how do you prioritize in-home caregivers, Donnell, would you say?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very good question, Donnell. My understanding is that individuals who are working, that is, home care givers, visiting nurses, individuals in this category, will, in all likelihood, be placed into the same category as the other healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, and others. We know that many of the home care givers, if they are providing medical care for individuals at home, many of these individuals are debilitated and are vulnerable. And so it's important for these individuals to receive the vaccine so that they don't pass on infection to others. So I would think, although I can't say for certain, I would think that they will be placed into the category of the healthcare practitioners and caregivers, and those individuals are going to be among the first groups to receive the vaccine or to be offered the vaccine.
Dr. Hewlett, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's an honor to be here and to share this information.
Dr. Dial Hewlett is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. Coming up, we talk with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call to discuss the historic rise in hate crimes in 2019 and what FBI statistics tell us. That's Attorney General Call after a news update here on the Ideas Network. The FBI's annual hate crime statistics report is out. We're talking about reported hate crimes across America and here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new report documented 51 hate crime murders. It's the most recorded since the FBI started collecting this data in 1991. Have you been a victim of a hate crime? What did you do? Did you report it? What do you want to know about hate crime trends here in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Josh Call is Attorney General of Wisconsin. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back on the program, Kate.
Well, explain for us, what is defined as a hate crime under law?
It varies from state to state and between federal law and state law. In Wisconsin, hate crimes are crimes that are committed based on a person's certain characteristics, whether it's race or religion or gender. And in Wisconsin, it's not a separate crime. It's a penalty enhancer. So if you commit a crime based on one of those reasons, you're facing more severe penalties than you would otherwise. But the basic idea is, if you're committing a crime against somebody based on one of their immutable characteristics, that's a hate crime.
How does the Wisconsin DOJ handle hate crimes? How are they investigated?
Generally speaking, most crime in Wisconsin of any kind is investigated by local law enforcement, by police departments or sheriff's offices, and prosecuted by DAs. And so typically that's the way that these crimes are investigated in Wisconsin. It's important to emphasize that if anybody witnesses a hate crime or they're a victim of a hate crime, they should contact local law enforcement. But I would also like to see a more coordinated statewide response. And so one of the things that I propose that we do is that our legislature pass legislation that would fund a hate crime hotline so that anybody who has information about hate crimes has a simple number that they can call to provide information and potentially to get referred to the best place to contact.
So a hotline, what do you think is the role of the, you know, Attorney General in preventing and prosecuting hate crimes? What is your role?
There are a few things I think are important for our State Department of Justice. As I mentioned, you know, most crime in Wisconsin is investigated and prosecuted at the local level, but first making sure that law enforcement and prosecutors are aware of what those rules are and that hate crime enhancements are being charged where they can, I think, is critical. We oversee training of law enforcement officers around the state, and continuing to train on those laws is an important part of what we do. We also defend the convictions when there are appeals of convictions in Wisconsin, including any challenges to sentences. But continuing to reinforce the importance of investigating these crimes and charging them where they exist, I think is critical. And then again, I would like to see a hate crime hotline housed at the Wisconsin Department of Justice so that we can help coordinate that response from a statewide level.
Do you find that hate crime is being documented, that the numbers are accurate when it comes to hate crimes in Wisconsin?
it appears, and this I think is an issue across the country, that there's significant underreporting of hate crimes. There's also an issue with proof. So just because a hate crime is committed doesn't mean that when a crime is charged, that it's charged as a hate crime, because it's one thing to prove that a crime was committed, but then proving that it was committed based on somebody's race, based on somebody's religion, is not always easy based on the facts of the case. And so it can pose a challenge. And as a result of that, I think that the numbers that we see understate the amount of hate crime that's happening.
The FBI statistics on hate crime for 2019 came out last week. What were your top line takeaways from the report?
Well, first of all, it's concerning that there appears to be an increase in hate crime. I think that there are several things going on. One is, I think there is an increased understanding that hate crimes should be reported. And so I'm hopeful that we are seeing more reporting, and that's part of what is reflected in the numbers. But it also seems to be clear that there is more hate crime going on as well. And, you know, there are a lot of things that can contribute to that, but there's no question that rhetoric that divides people from some of our top leaders, not only from the outgoing president, but from other elected officials as well, that divides people on the basis of race or religion or immigration status, that can foster a culture in which more hate crimes take place. You know, just a few days ago, we saw the Proud Boys displaying white supremacist symbols in Wauwatosa. And when leaders send a message that that kind of hatred is condoned, I think that does lead to more of these types of crimes.
According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of white nationalist hate groups grew by 55% between 2017 and 2019. What do you see is an extension of hate crimes and white nationalism?
Well, groups that are centered around the idea of white supremacy and of divisions based on race, there's no surprise that when you have a rise in those groups, you're going to see a rise in hate crimes. What we need is for leaders to condemn these groups, to make clear that white supremacy and that hate groups are absolutely unacceptable. But what we have seen for much of the last 4 years is the opposite of that. We've seen a suggestion that those groups will be at least tolerated, if not even supported by people at the highest levels of government. And that needs to change. We need to make very clear that the ideology being espoused by these groups is hateful and it's unacceptable.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call as we look at hate crime statistics from the FBI. There were more hate crime killings in 2019 than any other year on record. Why do you think that is? What have you been a victim of in terms of a hate crime? Join in at 800-642-1234. Connor is joining us from Madison this morning. Hi, Connor.
Hi. So I have a question for Attorney Call. When you have instances of police brutality, you know, oftentimes local law enforcement isn't interested in investigating or prosecuting themselves. So, you know, your office might hear a call from somebody and they might say, well, we don't take referrals except local law enforcement. So what's maybe a better way of handling those types of instances?
Go ahead, Attorney General.
Thanks for that question, Connor. So when there are cases that involve law enforcement officers, those are cases in which the investigative process is handled differently from a typical case because of the reason that you're suggesting, which is there needs to be an avoidance of any sort of conflict in the investigation of those cases. So at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, we have a Division of Criminal Investigation, which investigates crimes of statewide importance, and that would include any kind of official misconduct, not just any sort of crime that could be committed by a law enforcement officer, but anybody else in an official position. And that is an area that we consider to be crimes of statewide importance. So our Division of Criminal Investigation investigates public integrity cases, and also our assistant AGs in some cases prosecute those cases. So if there are crimes being committed by official actors, in that case, there is the kind of conflict that Connor's talking about with local law enforcement. And so they're referring those cases to the Wisconsin Department of Justice. It is an appropriate response. You know, another thing to do would be to contact a different law enforcement agency. But making sure that we have effective responses to any official misconduct is critical.
Should it be mandatory for local police agencies to collect and report hate crime data?
Local law enforcement is required to provide a variety of data as part of our data collection process. And that's one of the areas where our Wisconsin Department of Justice, not only with hate crimes, but with a variety of other crimes as well, works to both oversee the collection of that data and then to publish that data and make it publicly available so people can look at it. And so data about a variety of different types of crimes, including hate crimes, is reported. And if people want to see that data, they can go to our website.
Have police agencies in Wisconsin reported that data to the FBI? Does that get does that number and those statistics, are those reported then to the FBI for this overall U.S. data?
It's through the Department of Justice, yes. So the FBI data that you were mentioning early on in this segment, the way that the data collection process works is that local law enforcement agencies collect data, again, about a variety of different types of crime. They then provide that data to the Wisconsin Department of Justice. We gather that from law enforcement agencies around the state, make statewide data available, and we also provide that data to the federal authorities. And a similar process happens across the country. And so the data that we see from groups like the FBI is a accumulation of that data from states around the country.
What do the trends look like in Wisconsin when it comes to hate crime when you look at our numbers?
The numbers are very low in Wisconsin, so it's tough to discern too much of a trend from that. But it is concerning to see, you know, that what appears to be an overall increase in hate crimes. Again, the numbers are so low that I don't think that they reflect the majority of hate crimes, let alone all of them. So just looking at the numbers alone, I wouldn't draw conclusions from. But there's no question that we're seeing more of this hate crime activity around the country, and there's no reason to think that Wisconsin has been spared of that. And in fact, as I mentioned, you know, we just had the Proud Boys in Wisconsin displaying white supremacist symbols. So this is something that we need to make sure that law enforcement agencies around the state are responding to whenever there are any hate crimes that occur. And so I want to encourage anybody who's listening, if they witness a hate crime, and certainly if they're a victim of a hate crime, to report that to the appropriate authorities.
We got a pause there with Attorney General Josh Call. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Attorney General Josh Call about FBI hate crime statistics for 2019 and how hate-based attacks coincide with this rise of the white nationalist movement. We're talking about reported hate crimes across America and here in Wisconsin. Let's bring in Holly now from Burlington. Hi, Holly. What is your question?
Hi. I was wondering if the trend for local jurisdictions moving from UCR-based reporting to FBI-based reporting has had any increase in the hate crimes, or if those are unaffected.
UCR meaning Universal Crime Reporting, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Attorney General?
Well, first, thank you for that question, Holly. Holly is clearly an expert in data collection methods. One of the things that's happening is the way that we collect data from law enforcement agencies around the state is changing, and that's pursuant to federal guidelines. And so it's gone from categorical collection of data to what's called incident-based collection of data. So we're now collecting data based on specific incidents. And part of the idea behind that is to get more precise and more accurate information that's at the incident level, so there's more consistency in the way that, that crimes are categorized. I think it's too early to tell exactly what the impact of that's going to be on some of these data categories, because that that process is just happening now. And so, but I do think it helps us better understand what exactly is happening with these different types of crime.
Would one method be more comprehensive than the other?
The incident-based reporting, which is what is being shifted to, is more comprehensive. It's more precise because we're getting more fine-grained data. But it may be that we see that there's a difference in the numbers overall under the prior reporting system versus the new one.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call about hate crime reporting and statistics. Let's bring in John from Lake Halley. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, I had a question for you. You mentioned that the stats for hate crimes are pretty low, but does that take into account the crimes that don't get acknowledged hate crimes by the police?
I think you're breaking up there, John. Can you say that one more time?
Does the stats take into account the crimes that are being committed that are not acknowledged as hate crimes because the police refuse to accept?
Okay. Attorney General, can you address that?
Yeah, John. What I can say is that the numbers that we have are based on actual reported incidents. So anytime somebody's reporting it, that should be reflected in the data. What is not reflected is crimes that are not reported, or crimes where, ultimately that there's no official record of it. And so my view is that the numbers that we see understate the overall number of hate crimes that are happening both in Wisconsin and in the country. I do encourage anybody who's listening who has evidence of a hate crime to report it to law enforcement, because these are crimes that are taken very seriously and should be fully investigated and, if appropriate, prosecuted.
The 2012 killing of six people at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek is a tragedy in Wisconsin. Did that change policy in any way, or the way law enforcement handles hate crimes?
You know, first, what happened in Oak Creek, as you said, was an absolute tragedy. And it unfortunately was not the last mass shooting that that we've had in Wisconsin. I think that led to a lot of people recognizing how dangerous hate is and how it can foster criminal activity, and to recognize that this is a problem that impacts Wisconsin as it does other parts of the country. One of the things that we do at the Wisconsin Department of Justice is we staff the Wisconsin Statewide Intelligence Center, and that's a center that works with federal, local, and state law enforcement to identify threats to the safety and security of Wisconsinites. And if they receive information that there's a potential threat, they communicate with the appropriate law enforcement agencies around the state so that there's an appropriate law enforcement response. And one of the things that they are looking for is any kind of extremist violence or potential for violence. And so if they do get that kind of information, part of their charge is to follow up on it and to make sure that it's fully investigated.
Switching gears here, Attorney General, you filed a suit challenging parts of a law that was passed 2 years ago, an extraordinary session that limits your powers. And what are your concerns here about getting approval from the legislature's budget committee before settling certain lawsuits?
I guess first, just to go back a step, in as you mentioned, in December of 2018, after Governor Evers and I were elected, but before we took office, the state legislature passed legislation restricting the authority of our offices. And that has created a variety of practical problems for nearly 2 years now. Part of what they did was they limited the ability of the Wisconsin Department of Justice to resolve cases that are brought, changing the way that we resolve cases from what had been in place for decades. There was a state Supreme Court case decided earlier this year relating to those provisions. And what the state Supreme Court said was it wouldn't find those provisions unconstitutional in every application, but that they were leaving open the possibility that some of the applications of those statutes were unconstitutional. And that's what we're challenging in this case, is two of the applications of one of those laws. In particular, we're challenging laws that interfere with our ability to settle cases where statutes provide the Department of Justice the ability to bring in enforcement action, like environmental enforcement cases or consumer protection cases where a consumer in Wisconsin was cheated by a large company, and also cases where a state agency is litigating, for example, where a contract was breached.
Why can't DOJ and lawmakers come to an agreement, come to a consensus on a way to discuss confidential litigation?
We've been trying to do that for nearly 2 years now, unfortunately without success. The issue is that in resolving a settlement, there need to be confidential discussions. One obvious example is if you want to ask for a range of settlement authority, you can't make that public because the party that you're negotiating with, if they know what your range is going to get, it's going to end up being a bad deal for the state in that case. But so far, the Joint Finance Committee has refused to have these discussions in any sort of confidential setting. And because of that, we've been inhibited in our ability to move forward with the Joint Finance Committee and trying to figure out a framework for resolving some of these cases. But when it comes to environmental enforcement or consumer protection enforcement, you know, the other thing is we just need to be able to resolve these cases. Our attorneys who are litigating these on behalf of Wisconsinites need to be able to have the authority to get those cases resolved. And having a legislative committee weigh in on each of these resolutions slows the process down and ultimately makes it more difficult for us to protect our environment and to protect consumers.
Last question, election recount. Are there any open investigations underway at the DOJ of alleged instances of election fraud or election irregularities of the presidential election?
I won't comment on any specifics. You know, there was a charge, I think, just reported yesterday of a voter fraud case in the Cedarburg area. But generally speaking, the amount of fraud in the system is extremely minimal. We had a very safe, secure election. Despite there being a pandemic, we had a record number of people come out to vote. And Wisconsinites can have a lot of confidence that the results that we have are reliable and that this was an election that was conducted very professionally.
Will we be able to certify results by December 1?
That's my expectation. That's when the recount is required to be completed, and that's the certification deadline. So unless there is some sort of court order that were to bar the certification from moving forward, and there would be no basis for that in the law, we should be able to certify it by December 1st.
Attorney General, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call, Attorney General of Wisconsin. Just ahead, we're joined by the author of 40 Thieves on Saipan. We're exploring the story of a platoon in the Pacific Theater in World War II. Will you interview a veteran at Thanksgiving over Zoom? What is their story about World War II? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.